Session number 28897, reel number 8.
So I wanted to ask you, you know, what were the consequences? That presumably you had to go and collect your pigeons.
Yes, well, I don't recall that we got into any trouble, but no, we were well on our way before we realised that we'd lost, left them behind in the aircraft we'd had to abandon. And so we just went along, but we still had all our containers in our bomb bays that we dropped to the to some resistance group in Europe somewhere. I don't know where it was, of course, now. But, nothing. I can't recall that anything was said about the pigeons when we got back, but I might have got a rap on the knuckles, I don't know.
You're mentioning that you were kind of enjoying this work that you were involved with.
I found it was interesting. Yes, it was interesting. It was a bit nerve-wracking at times, I suppose. Yes, but interesting. Yes,
I was going to ask whether there were times when you really sort of wondered, you know, what the hell you were doing.
Yes, well, we had a few little incidents that I might mention. Not particularly dangerous ones, but one night we were going out on one of these operations, and I used to call the rear gunner up every 10 minutes. Have I told you this story before?
Yeah, I think you mentioned that you'd call him up because, apart from anything else, he might be frozen.
Yes, that's right. And on this particular night, I called him up, and he was okay, and so I was happy enough. And then, sometime later, my call light went on. I've mentioned that we had call lights. And I just asked the crew who was calling. And the rear gunner said, "It's me, Skipper." He said, "Don't worry about it." He said, "I'm just shuffling around in my turret." And his calls button was on up the top above his head. He said, "I've bumped my head on the call button. I haven't got any problem." And so I accepted that, and then I went along for another 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, half an hour, whatever it was, until I decided to call him again. And I called him, and I got no reply at all. So I tried this several times, and I thought, oh, perhaps he's sick or something. So I asked Les Steele, the wireless operator, if he'd go down and have a look, see what the problem was with Bill. And he went down, and the next thing I knew, he called me up and said, "We haven't got a rear gunner. He's not here." And of course, I was flabbergasted. I thought, "I'd cut it out, Les," or something like that. "Have a good look." And then he made me feel a bit foolish. He said, "Where am I going to look in the tail of an aircraft?" But at any rate, I might have said he might be on the toilet or something like that. I don't recall exactly what we said, but and then I asked Dennis, the flight engineer, if he would go down and have a look too. So he went down and had a look, and he reported back and said, "Yes, that's quite right. The rear gunner's gone. His helmet's hanging over the guns, but his parachute's gone and he's gone." So that was the end of our rear gunner. We've never heard to this day why or what happened to him. It did make me recall a conversation I'd had with him a couple of weeks before. He'd come to me one night, and we were having a bit of a chat. And he said, "You know, George," he said, "I don't like these long night trips, going out there at 3 o'clock in the morning and on those long trips." He said, "A man's at his lowest ebb then, you know." I said something about, "Well, it's our job, Bill, you know, we'd all rather be in bed," and left it at that. But in hindsight, he might have been cooking up something or trying to give me a message, I don't know.
Whereabouts were you flying at this time?
We're over France somewhere, yes, over France somewhere, but quite a way in, I think. But of course, when we got back and I reported the fact that, I asked someone if they could operate the turret, the wireless operators had also done a bit of training in gunnery. They were called wireless operator air gunners. But apparently the turret was jammed. He must have kicked it or something, when he bailed out, and they said it wouldn't work. So I said, well, there's not much point in sitting in there if the turret won't work. So we just went on without a gunner. And of course, when I got back to base, I reported this, and there was a big flap on because this was 6 weeks before D-Day. And so the intelligence people bundled us all into a truck and took us off somewhere and interrogated us all separately. And I was asked whether I said anything that could have conveyed the idea that I wanted him to bail out or something like that. And I said, well, not to my knowledge. I don't recall saying anything that caused anybody to bail out. And they asked the crew too. None of the crew had any instruction from me or anything like that. So that was that. So we were all sent off to bed then. But next morning, Bill was in the same hut as me. And the next morning, there were a lot of intelligence people roaming around. They undid all his kit bag and went through all his paraphernalia. And we did hear on the grapevine, although I was never told anything officially, that he had been a member of the Communist Party. So we all made an educated guess that maybe he was going to help the people on the ground. A lot of them were politically motivated, and some of them were communists, I think. But we don't really know what happened to him. And we've tried on the internet, or friends of mine have tried on the internet to go through all the POW detail we can find. We've never been able to find out anything about him. And whether that was his proper name is another matter that I don't know. So that was one little incident.
I want to talk a little bit more about that in relation to the situation, given the closeness to something like a big operation like D-Day. Was there possibly information that he may have known about D-Day that could have been a danger to...
Of course, no one knew when or where, but we had been doing quite large operations over Salisbury Plain. One night in particular, it was in April sometime, I can't remember the exact date, but the whole of the British Airborne Division was airlifted with the help of the Americans, and there was a massive exercise done in Salisbury Plains, and we knew it was a big operation because we could see a lot of other aircraft around and whatnot, but no one told us exactly what it was. But since reading the history of the airborne divisions, I found out that was a dress rehearsal for D-Day, and our job that night was to drop a glider. We had to drop a glider. Some people were dropping paratroops, some were dropping gliders, and we weren't stupid. We knew that D-Day was coming, and but we didn't know when or where. But as it turned out, it was about 6 weeks before D-Day when Bill opted out. So then we got a new rear gunner, and he was a Canadian, and he stayed with us right through. Yeah, so George Gelinas. Yes, he was I went and saw him after the war. Went over to Toronto and looked him up. Yes, so that was that was the type of thing that was happening all the time. We were doing all these exercises with the airborne people. That was the biggest, the real dress rehearsal, so I'm told.
Mm-hmm.
But there were lots of... another night too, I had a bit of a story to tell. I was taking a glider full of troops out to over Salisbury Plains, and I don't know what we were going to do with them now. I've forgotten whether we were going to go to a dropping zone somewhere, or whether it was an exercise where we were taking them out to do the trip and bring them back again. But at any rate, all of a sudden the rear gunner, and this was the one that bailed out later on, he called me up and said, "We've lost our glider, skipper." And I said, "Well, I haven't released it." He said, "Well," he said, "the tow rope's gone with it." And so I thought, "Good Lord, I haven't released it. And I'll be in trouble, though. If the tow rope's gone with the glider, they'll reckon I have, you see." So I was a very worried little boy then for a while. And I called up base and told them what had happened. And they accused me of releasing it. And wanted to know why I did it, you know. But nothing wrong with doing it if it was in a cloud or it was dangerous. But there was nothing like that at the particular time, so I said, "I don't know what happened." And got back to base and got briefed for that, debriefed for that, and I told them that we hadn't released it, and the bomb aimer who sat next to me as second pilot, he reiterated that. And so the puzzle remained until next morning when they sent people out to have a look at my aircraft. And they found out that the coupling had picked up some little gravel pebbles. gravel pebbles. And they'd lodged under the coupling, and apparently the coupling hadn't connected properly, you see. So that let me off the hook. Although we were told later on that you air crews should inspect those couplings in future, see. But we had assumed that the people putting the glider on the back would have done that up till then. You know, after that, I always had a look when I went out to the aircraft. I had a look at it. But and then, of course, these poor old glider pilots, they were left there in the middle of the night in April, and the weather was still pretty cold, freezing cold there. And they had to land this thing, you see, on Salisbury Plains. So I was pretty worried, boy, about that. I thought, God, what if they crash and kill everybody and this type of thing? But at any rate, next day I found out that they had landed okay, and they sat there freezing all night in the glider until they could get a message out and get someone to come and get them. And all my mates were saying, "Look, there's a mob of glider pilots..." Not just glider pilots, but airborne troops. "Looking for George Oliver. Have you seen him around anywhere?" So I kept a low profile. they reckon these chaps are going to give me a bit of a thumping, you see. At any rate, I heard no more about it.
What sort of blokes were they, paratroopers?
Oh, they were good blokes. We got on well with them. Yes. I didn't have any trouble with them. And we got on well with the glider pilots. We had something in common. I even went up in the hawser at least once with them, just for the experience of it, you know.
What was that experience like?
Well, the thing that impressed me most once we got up and were released was the silence, you know, after being in noisy aircraft all my life. And it was just absolute silence. And also the approach was much steeper than what we'd make in the aeroplane. They could go down. When we say they're gliders, some people might imagine they're like these little gliders that fly around in the thermals. They weren't like that. There was only one place they could glide, and that was downwards. When you first released them, they went up a bit. And I suppose that was because they got a bit of increased lift, maybe from the slipstream, or whether it was just the speed they were doing without the weight of the tow rope to keep them in position. But apart from that, they always just glided down. And of course, that's where the skill for the glider pilots came in, to actually release so that they could land exactly where they wanted to on the DZ. Because we used to navigate until they could see the DZ, and then we used to call them, I used to talk to them then. So, you know, we used to ask them whether we were in a good spot for them, whether they wanted us to go a bit to starboard or a bit to port or so forth, and like that, and then they would release. And then we'd be stuck with the big, long 300-foot tow rope hanging out the back. And we used to go and drop these, and I've probably mentioned before, we really enjoyed that little job, because when they hit the ground, they used to snake along like a great big snake, and being young, we thought this was a bit of fun. But there was a definite dropping area for these tow ropes. Mm. Now, that was one little incident.
People talk of operations like the German paratroop drop on Crete.
Yes.
And the sort of not debacle, but certainly the loss of life.
Yes.
That resulted when such numbers of paratroopers were dropped. And assumedly you were realising that these gliders were for a specific purpose, and that, you know, paratroopers were going to be dropped here, there, and
the other. Oh, yes, yes. We really knew that it was going to be D-Day in our minds. And also they started to give us special rations as June approached. We got an orange once a week, and we got a little bar of chocolate. And, we thought at the time, yeah, they must be expecting high casualties here to be treating us like this. But anyway, I gave my chocolates to Jean, of course, because I wasn't married then, we were engaged then. But I gave my chocolates to Jean. I might have eaten the orange, I don't remember. Little things like that. But, and then we'd been confined to barracks a couple of times closer on, and because the thing was postponed a bit, you know, here and there. And so we really knew what we were doing. We knew.
I wanted to ask whether you were speaking with the paratroopers at all about what they thought might be going on.
No, I don't recall that I did. I spoke more with the glider pilots, really, because we had something in common, really. And we didn't have quite the same... I don't recall... Well, I was in the sergeant's mess at the time, and it might be just as well to mention now that... Oh, thanks, love. That is that going over? Okay,
that's all right. That's all right. We've just been served orange juice.
yes, that's right. We've just been served orange juice. Yes. What was I on about?
Well, you were talking about
the paratroopers. I was in the sergeant's mess, and incidentally, Ron was in the. He got his commission before I got mine, and he was in the officer's mess at that time. So some of the things Ron recalls about what was said and so forth wouldn't apply to me, because I was in it. He might have heard what the CO was saying and things like that, you know, and the senior officers in the officers' mess, whereas in the sergeant's mess, warrant officer was the highest rank in the sergeant's mess, so we didn't get any real information down there. But of course most of the glider pilots were sergeants, you see, or flight sergeants, and so they were in our mess with us at times, whereas the paratroopers, most of them were privates, so we didn't have the same contact with them socially at all, really. We just used to meet them down there when we were doing exercises and have a bit of a chat. And I think that was the main reason that we had more to do with the glider pilots.
Obviously something is in the making people are obviously preparing you for something.
Oh, yes.
In what way were you able to, and you mentioned Jean, and we should mention her, in what way were you able to take your mind away from this sort of scenario that was obviously being hatched?
Well, I don't know that I took my mind away from it. What I did manage to do was apply my mind to the task in hand, more or less. And if I got a bit nervous any time, I might have mentioned that I used to want to have a pee before we got in the aircraft. There was a bit of apprehension here and there on the ground, you know. But once I got in the aircraft, I didn't feel any undue strain in the training period.
I suppose what I was getting at was, how did you, you know, okay, when you had those times of leave off, how did you sort of separate yourself from this operational?
Well, I mean, I went and saw Jean. Well, before her, I had a few dates and that, and I just socialised with people and had a few beers and that type of thing.
Was it difficult to sort of maintain a normal life during this part of the war, or during any part of the war? Was it possible to literally say, right, well, the war is my work, I'm not at work now?
Well, I think I didn't actually think like that, I don't think, but when I was away, I certainly didn't think anything about the war generally.
So you didn't bring your work home with you?
No, I didn't. I certainly didn't bring my work home with me in that respect. I just enjoyed the time I could, while I could. And the only time I got a bit despondent was later on in the war when the army were going so well in Europe, and then the Germans broke through the Battle of the Bulge. You remember that? And I can remember going off my face a bit about that, saying, oh, this bloody war will never end, and carrying on. And one of my mates said, what sort of talk's that, Oliver? And that was one time when I did get a bit agitated about what was happening, you know. But, yes, I'll never forget that.
People had mentioned to me that it was difficult to make close friends in this scenario because you were never quite sure whether you were coming back up for the next mission or whether they were coming back.
No.
Was this something you experienced?
Yes, although not the sort. Well, it didn't make the. It didn't feel that it was a long term. Friendship, I don't think. I don't know that I thought about it that much, but I had some good mates that I used to have a beer with and used to talk about flying. And
you met Jean, that's pretty long term.
I met Jean, yeah, that's been long term. And that was one of the reasons I didn't dwell on it all when I was away. I was more interested in Jean than I was in what was going on elsewhere. So, and her family was a bit of an anchor for me, you know. Really.
People talk of getting married during wartime and you know, the risks being taken, all that sort of thing. Was it ever a problem for you getting close to a woman during wartime because of this fact that, you know, you may...
No, well, people often asked me that, and at the time people said, oh, it's a silly thing to do, George. My dad told me about all the broken marriages from the First World War and so forth, and but I thought, and they said, you know, you should really wait till it's all over and that things settle down. Now, I don't know whether Jean and I talked about that in length, but at any rate, the consensus was that we didn't know when the war was going to end, didn't have any idea, and also we didn't know anything about the future, what the future held. So what was the point of waiting for something that might never happen? We were in love and we just wanted to get... Well, in those days, you got married. shacking up wasn't sort of, I suppose it was a bit of it went on, but I mean it wasn't the general thing. And that was why we got married. We just wanted to.
When did you get married? Before or after D-Day?
After D-Day, 1st of August. And it was only 6 weeks later that I got shot down at Arnhem. So she missed being a widow then by about a couple of seconds probably. But anyway, that's another story we'll get to.
We'll get to that too. Where were the places that you caught up? I mean, people talk of going to London and...
Well, before I met Jean, we went to London a couple of times, and I do remember one little occasion. We went to a club. I'm not sure which one it was now. There were clubs there that the Aussies used to go to, and we went to this club, and I was there with my Canadian bomb aimer, and he was commissioned at the time when he joined our crew. He was commissioned, all the rest of us were non-commissioned. And I was sitting there with old Chuck, and I think Les Steele was there too, the other West Australian. And this chap came in and bought us a beer, came up to us, bought us a beer, and asked us a bit about the Air Force and said he was a merchant navy man. And Where do you come from, he said. And so we said Perth. Oh, he said, oh yes, all right. So named a few streets in Fremantle and walked down Barrack Street and all this sort of stuff, you see. So we knew that he'd been to Perth, all right, or else he'd done his homework very well. And then he asked my Canadian friend, and he said Toronto, and or one of the cities in Canada anyhow. And, oh yeah, there's such and such a street in Toronto, and what's the ports like and everything. So we decided that he definitely was a merchant navy man, all right. And then a little bit later on, he said to the Canadian, do you like Canadian bourbon, is it? Bourbon, their whiskey, is that what they call it?
Bourbon, yeah.
So Chuck said, oh yes, he said, well, you can't get that here. And he said, look, he said, there's a ship... ship in now, and I've got a mate or two. He said, I can get you a bottle if you like. He said, I'll be coming in tomorrow. He said, but he'll want the money straight away, you see. So Chuck said, oh, that's all right. But just then I went to the toilet, and someone else followed me in, tapped me on the shoulder and said, you want to watch that bloke? Don't have anything to do with him. So I went back, and I think he must have twigged, because he just hastily got up and said cheerio and off he went. Well, I don't know whether Chuck had given him the money or not, but anyway, he probably had. But and of course we went back the next day, but he didn't turn up. So that was a little experience on leave. So that took our mind off everything for a while anyhow. Well, what are we up to now then?
Well, you're talking about the sort of black marketeering happening. That's right.
Yes, well, I think I mentioned I made friends with an English pilot, and when we were training, and we used to go to a roadhouse and get a meal, and I think some of that might have been black market, but... he didn't ask for anything, but I don't know anything about the black market really, apart from that.
The people doing the best they can in a hard situation, presumably.
Yes, 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 yes. It's hard to put your mind back into how you felt in those days, really, but. Well, we managed to survive anyhow, so I managed to survive without having a fit of nerves or anything like that.